Welcome to the Solari Report. Today is Thursday, May 14, 2009. I'm Catherine Austin Fitz, and I'm delighted you could join me this evening. Tonight, we're going to review the top stories in money and markets, address questions from you, and ask Catherine. Then we're going to be joined by Franklin Sanders of the Money Changers for our precious metals update, then a discussion of the movie Point of No Return. Money and markets. I hardly know where to start. One of my favorite quotes from the Buddha is, those who live in a state of, those who are awake live in a state of constant amusement. And all week long, I've been collecting different stories to talk about in money and markets. I've ended up with a pile that is many inches high. It's been an incredible week, and sort of my theme for this week is the deals go down. I want to start, there's a wonderful video I put up on the blog on Friday called, and I titled it, On Auditing the Fed. It's congressional testimony by the Inspector General of the Governors of the Federal Reserve Board. And in the testimony, she is asked by Congressman Grayson to explain where some of the $1 trillion of bailout loans have gone. And she explains that she doesn't know, and in fact, investigating that may not be under her jurisdiction because that's the New York Fed and not the Federal Reserve. And it's an extraordinary, just an extraordinary moment when you see how the system really works, because you have an overt process, sort of the formal governmental process, and then you have a covert process. And the covert process is making all the decisions very quickly, and the overt process is really clueless as to what is going on and sort of is working at a snail's pace. I know there was a moment during the testimony on the HUD loan sales many years ago. The FHA mortgage portfolio has, at the time, had about $400 billion of mortgage insurance. And the whole economics of the portfolio is the default rate times the mortgage recovery rate on defaulted loans plus the overhead. And those are basically your expenses. And all the economics of the portfolio is driven by these three variables. And so the recovery rate is unbelievably important in sort of saving money for the agency. And my attorney asked the HUD Inspector General, what was the recovery rate before, during, and after the HUD loan sales? And she looked at him like he was nuts, and she said, well, I have no idea. Well, that's literally like if somebody came and asked you, you know, what your costs were in your basic business, and you said, I have no idea. But it's a very magical moment of looking inside the machinery and seeing, you know, that things are really – really different than they see. So if you haven't watched it, I really recommend it. It's called Unauditing the Fed. So so anyway, $10 to $12 trillion in bailouts have occurred, and my guess, just from watching what's going on in the mortgage markets, is that we seem to have gotten our arms around funding the worst part of the mortgage liabilities with the credit default swaps. We've talked for the last 2 weeks about the Freddie Mac story. 2 weeks ago, we talked about the chief financial officer being found dead in his basement, the story being that he committed suicide. Last week, I talked about an article in the Wall Street Journal pointing out sort of going through the history of his work for the year up to his death and really designed to persuade you that this man had committed suicide. And I said when I read the story, okay, now I'm really convinced the guy didn't commit suicide. We have today in the Wall Street Journal an editorial pointing out, or this week in the Wall Street Journal, pointing out that the loan loss reserves for Fannie Mae are very different than Freddie Mac, and Freddie Mac is reserving far less for its losses than Fannie Mae. And again, bringing up the issue, what in the world is going on in Freddie Mac, and what is this whole story about? So there's clearly something going on there. We don't know what the facts are. We know the official story is a bunch of bunk. Continuing in the mortgage market, three things were announced literally within the same 24 hours. Countrywide, during the housing bubble, was the number one mortgage lender in terms of volume. And so if there was any company that put the bubble on the map. It was Countrywide. And Countrywide was a company that was a very big feeder of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, and in fact was when I was on the advisory board of Fannie Mae, Angela Mozilla was on the advisory board as well. So he was very active giving senior officers special deals, same with congressmen. So announcing today a couple of things all at the same time. One is the Bank of America, which has now purchased Countrywide, taken it in at the request of the Fed, is changing the branding all over the country, and Countrywide is now going to be Bank of America Mortgage. So the name Countrywide is disappearing. One of the AGs, in fact, it was Indiana, announces a settlement with Countrywide. So we're watching sort of Countrywide's liabilities be cleaned up. And at the same time, we have the SEC announce that they're recommending to the commissioners, so it's a staff recommendation up to the commissioners, which is usually accepted, that Angela Mozilla, as an individual, is going to be prosecuted for civil wrongdoing related to Countrywide. So literally, the company and the operations are tucked away safely, and the one individual is peeled off with. And my theory on what this is going to be is, you know, the crowd wants somebody to be held accountable. So they're going to help hold accountable the CEO, and basically all the money's disappeared. So once again, we don't see the question asked, where did all the money go? Who has all the money? How do we get that money back? How do we use that money to provide restitution to the people who've been harmed? That's not the conversation. The money is offshore. The operation is tucked into Bank of America, where it can continue to make money for Bank of America and blow bubbles on another occasion. And we have one guy peeled off to be thrown to the crowd, interestingly enough, with no criminal indictments. At the same time, there's another video that I put up on the blog, very interesting little video on one of the other mortgage companies that got taken over by Citibank, and the implications are there's criminal fraud. Again, the people targeted are the more entrepreneurial, smaller CEOs. The big banks and the big players are being left untouched. It all leaves me with a feeling that what we're watching is the big banks have sort of defined their liability position, whether it's through the mortgage-backed securities, the mortgages or the credit default swaps they're on. J.P. Morgan has consumed Bear Stearns and Lehman, and AIG has provided tremendous sort of resources and air protection to a variety of people. And so they think they've got the big banks and the system covered, and now they're leaving it to the little players to work out the game of musical chairs and fight around the scraps. What remains to be seen is how this is going to work out at the county and municipal level, because the counties and municipalities are left hurting. We see California this week asking the Treasury for help through TARP because it just is dealing with so many significant deficits. That's going to continue because the big problem in this whole picture is you can pump through the Fed and Treasury money to keep the corporations up and even keep the Dow Jones up, because that's keeping corporations up. But when you have massive unemployment, how are you going to keep the people up? And if the people aren't buying, how are you going to keep the municipalities up? Because you can pump government profits with defense contracts and all sorts of backdoor money. It's much harder to pump municipalities up when they're losing sales tax revenue and are dealing with the expenses, which are extraordinary, of having more and more people with declining income and no jobs. Now, to add to that, to add insult to injury, the Secretary of the Treasury came out this week and said, well, you know, we have a real problem fiscally, and it's very hard to talk about this without laughing till we cry. Fiscally, we have a problem because Social Security is going to run out and Medicare is really going to run out. And so we need to deal with these things. Now, I assure you, ladies and gentlemen, if we have $12 to $14 trillion to dig banks out of intentional fraud, we can afford to spend print $12 to $14 trillion to shore up Medicare and Social Security. But the reality is, you know, the plan has been to shore up the few at the cost of the many. And so we need to watch this carefully. One of the things to watch, there's an article by Ralph Nader that I posted up on the blog what he's saying is single payer is off the table. They're basically, the new administration is pushing for something that will be very, very attractive and enticing to the full complement of corporate players in the healthcare market. And so there's no way to deal with the Medicare issues without dealing from everything to healthy food, healthy water, healthy lifestyles, you know, not having half the population run around on drugs, you know, with all these fundamental issues, as well as the fact that we've built up a medical infrastructure in this country which is simply not economic and not sane and not culturally healthy. You know, let me just tell you one story. I had a cousin who hurt his knee in high school while playing football the other day. It happened about a year or two ago, and he went into Jackson, Tennessee to have outpatient surgery on his knee. It turned out he was insured by his family's insurance. The school had a special policy for accidents, and his dad had a special policy for accidents on the kids, who he was insured three times. So whatever the bill was, it wasn't the family's problem. But when they got the bill for an outpatient surgery for one day in Jackson, Tennessee, it was $64,000. So that's the indication of a system which really needs to be re-envisioned and reinvented, but that doesn't look like what is going to happen. Now, what does it mean to you? I think it's so very important that all of us, for planning purposes, find ways of envisioning how we're going to have a wonderful life without depending on Medicare and Social Security, and number one. And number two, as they start to look to re-engineer the system, one of the things that's easy to look at is going to be 401ks. And so, again, you know, as you know, I fret about the 401ks and the rules there, but I think it's worth watching that debate and see if it starts to the various proposals that have been floated of integrating the 401k system with the Social Security system. We want to watch to see that doesn't happen, or if it does, we're ready to take action. I also posted a quick article on capital controls. I talked about those last week. We continue to see noise to insist that disclosure of offshore capital, different things happening to encourage people to not invest offshore. Again, looking to move more subsidy back on shore to replace all the money that's been drained. There's a lot of press reports sort of rising towards the mainstream about the drug business, about global narcotics trafficking. I wanted to just touch on it. I'm going to do a Soleri report in June on this because I want you to start to see the thread of narco dollars that weaves through the news and also weaves through your community enough so that you know how to sort of avoid and protect yourself from it. But let me just give a couple hints of what we're seeing. We're seeing, you know, articles about the Mexican drug war that sort of quieted down when the flu hit. We're seeing more and more articles about the drug flows as they relate to Afghanistan, Pakistan, and Iran, and what they have to do with our military presence there. And you're starting to see more and more action I'm seeing in the communities I'm associated with in and around the drug business and enforcement. It seems as the economy dips down, we're seeing more action in those areas and in the illegal economy. So stay tuned for June. I wanted to also mention we've seen the stock market, incredible efforts to get the stock market up and keep it up. And with that has come all sorts of chatter by various business leaders that say, you know, we're recovering, we're in a recovery, all sorts of positive language to encourage the investment community to feel bullish about the outlook for the Dow Jones and the American and the global economy, because it's a global phenomenon. And one of the terms you're seeing is something that I've never heard before. And, in fact, earlier tonight I asked Franklin, have you ever heard this? It's called green shoots. We're seeing green shoots. We're now using sort of biological terms to describe the financial markets. But green shoots, and I assume that it relates to, you know, in spring you see the green shoots coming out of the ground. And And I think that that's a very interesting use of words, because there have been more and more indications, I gave a hint of it last week, of money sitting, waiting to come back in to do things that are green, clean technology that we've talked about, green projects. But I put up a piece on the blog that I encourage you to take a look at. In February, the Dubai Chamber of Commerce proposed doing a redevelopment of a portion of Dubai in the, you know, in the Emirates, to make that portion food self-sufficient and energy self-sufficient with all sorts of amazing green technology. Now, the reason I point that out is watch for that to come here, and watch for a lot of the money that's been amassed offshore to want to play in that wave. So watch for the word green, because it's coming. Now, before I move on to ask Catherine, I want to talk about the last sort of piece of news this week that I think it's important to talk about. But before I do, I just want to underscore that I'm going to say a couple things which are tough or a little uncomfortable. And so if you don't want to hear about the darker side of life, may want to put the phone down for about 3 or 4 minutes and come back, because I'm going to have to talk about a subject which is a little bit unpleasant. So with that warning, let me just get going on the issue of torture. We saw the real momentum gather around the idea of illuminating what the torture process has been, and even possibly indicting or holding accountable some of the officials to date who've been involved in authorizing or perpetrating this kind of torture. And that was really gathering steam until the Mexican flu hit, or the swine flu hit, and then ba-boom, you know, it seemed to taper down, but the drumbeat has started again. And this week we saw the president determine that he was going to reverse his position and requested the Department of Justice move to make sure that the courts had determined that certain class of photos would be unsealed on May 28th. So the Department of Justice is now moving to make sure that those photos never see the light of day. So we have the president, who's made a big deal about transparency, saying, no, we don't want these photos made public. And the reason is we think it will put our troops in Afghanistan and Iraq at risk. Now, what is all of this about? What this is all about, according to the reporters who know and have followed the torture story, is that there are pictures of young boys being sodomized, so young boys being raped. Part of the allegations is that it is being done in front of the women that they came in with, so presumably their mother or relative. These pictures are very graphic and very clear, and it is rape of young boys. So in America, rape of children is bad enough. Homosexual rape is even worse. So why would Obama not let those pictures be made public, if that is the case? If you said to me, is it possible that this happened? I would say, oh, yes, it's not only very possible, it's probable. If there's torture, then that's probable. I would expect that. Just as some backdrop, the contractor who was hired to run courts and enforcement and judiciary on a $500 million contract in Iraq was, in fact, a contractor who had very significant litigation for their role in Eastern Europe with sex slave trafficking. So we have someone who is, you know, there's Army CID videotape proof that they've been engaged in sex slave trafficking, and they're chosen to be the lead contractor on the courts, judiciary, or police. So it's not surprising that something like this should happen, although it's something which I think most Americans find very hard to fathom or very shocking, that this could be as prevalent as it could. Now, why would Obama not want the photos to be made public? Well, it's back to the red button problem again. And for those of you who haven't heard the red button story, if you do a search on the blog, there's a post under the glossary about the red button story. But essentially, it's a story of the majority of Americans not wanting to stop illegal flows of money. So money laundering, of narcotics trafficking, and all the different kinds of dirty money. I mean, America is, we are the global leaders, or certainly a significant part of the global leaders in narcotics trafficking and illegal businesses, or the money laundering thereof. So Americans don't want that money to stop if it means the economy will crash, if it means our taxes will go up, if it means our government checks will stop, if it means our mutual funds will go down. And yet we want the money to keep coming. We want the president and the White House and the governmental infrastructure to do whatever they have to do to keep the money working. At the same time, we want to feel good about ourselves. So we do not want to look at the pictures of what it takes to keep the system going, because the reality is that we live in a war economy. And our core competency is, one of our core competencies is force. And the central banking warfare model means you print people and you get people to take your paper, and you get them to take your paper in exchange for their labor or exchange for their natural resources. And so you subsidize your way of living with their hard work and their natural resources. And that's how the game works. And in fact, slavery in all of its many forms, and I should do a Solari report on slavery in all of its very forms, is by far the number one most profitable business on the planet today. So, you know, more profitable than narcotics trafficking, and you could never get narcotics trafficking to go without slavery. So, and you certainly couldn't get it to go without sex slavery. So here's the conundrum, and it comes back to you and me and every person listening to this Solari report. Many of us have CDs at our local bank. Many of us have dollars in our wallet. Many of us have treasury securities. We're financing this. And the question we need to ask is, would we say we want the pictures made public? Because, in fact, if you make the pictures public, then you put the whole system at significant risk. Now, of course, you know I would make the pictures public, because I absolutely believe what the quote I always give you that my pastor used to say, if we can face it, God can fix it. And we're not going to face it unless we start to see the pictures of what it is that takes, what it takes to keep our treasury securities up and our dollars worth something and the cheap goods coming in to the, you know, from China. But ultimately, what I hope is that when you think about the torture story, or you think about actions, or you think about your political opinions or your political commitments or pressures or actions that you take, I would ask that you integrate your money with what the president and the governmental infrastructure has done, and you think profoundly about how you can start to push the red button. Because remember, as I've said many times, the president can't push the red button until 80% of Americans are willing to push the red button. Now, one of the interesting things, going back to the sort of go green, the way to push the red button is to bring out of the closet a lot of the new technology is available, because, in fact, if you do that, there's enough wealth so that you can turn the red button green, and a lot of that comes down to integrating new technology, not just into our enterprises, but in our communities. So there is a way out, but when you look at the torture story, it's so important that we not just say, look, this is those bad guys doing it. What you need to know is the CIA and the Department of Justice and the military, all these guys are out there implementing and keeping the red button from being pushed, are at the end of the day doing what we're asking them to do. And if we criticize them for doing what they have to do it, we're putting them in a double bind. And it's that double bind, if we can heal that double bind and bring transparency to that double bind and transform that double bind, then there is a pathway to a whole new world that is wonderful. So that's why I wanted to beat the torture story to death. Ask Catherine. Most of the questions I want to go through with Franklin, but very briefly, we've got a couple of good ones. One was on the Microsoft. Microsoft announced this week that it was going to raise capital in significant amounts, in the billions, to buy shares back and to also make some new technology investments. And they didn't say, but the implication was sort of end stockpile cash. And the question from one of the subscribers was, you know, what does this mean? One possibility is, of course, this would be a signal to the market that the market really does have legs. If someone like Microsoft is going to buy their share back, I think, you know, given what we have to live through in the next 6 months, I think that's nuts. We later saw an announcement shortly thereafter that Intel had been fined over $1 billion by the European Commission and for antitrust violations. And so my guess is one of the reasons that Microsoft wanted to raise the capital is any big problem with Intel is a problem for Microsoft, and any big problem with Intel and Intel stock is a problem for the tech stocks. So my guess was it was you know, it was a little bit of a preemptive defensive move. Second question is, what would it take to create a new community wizard? For those of you who don't know what community wizard is, you can read about it in the Dylan Reed story that you can link to from the homepage. If you just see the name is Dylan Reed and the aristocracy of stock profits down on the left in the homepage. Community wizard was a software tool that I was building at Hamilton Securities, my company in the 90s, which allowed the user to come in through the internet and work with the software to help them understand what their place was. Is my community my zip code or my congressional district or my county or my municipality? So define the boundaries of your place and then start to collect all the data related to federal sources and uses of both contracts, appropriations, credit regulations, and all sort of federal governmental resources in your place. And our hope as we kept building was to add state and local as well. And the idea being these are shared resources, and the more people can see how all the money works in their community, they can see opportunities to re-engineer it. Because if you're going to re-engineer government, the way to do it is not to re-engineer the different federal agencies, but instead to re-engineer all the money in a place, because there's fantastic amounts of money and fantastic sort of state, federal, and local overhead. Anyway, I've made several attempts. I took the part of the software was stolen when all of our software and systems were under court control. But with what was remaining, at various times I've taken copies of everything and given it to a variety, or tried to give it to a variety of open source software developers and other people who are interested in this area. And then at one point I tried to lead a wiki development that would help do this. And essentially where I've come out is that I would much prefer to see communities individually and very organically do this, because I think any centralized or very open process through the internet, if every community in America takes all its data and puts it up on the web, it's just going to make it easier for the pro-centralization team. So, frankly, one of the things I encourage people to do is to keep their community databases, you know, very paperfully on their kitchen table in a folder and not necessarily put it up on the internet. So my next step is I'm going to be working with the Financial Permaculture Institute in Hohenwald to provide some curriculum that we'll do some on the Solari report about how to map out your financial ecosystem. So how do you define what the money is around you, and how do you learn about it and enough to start to really make a difference in your life and the life of your family and neighbors. And I'm hoping that curriculum and that information can be taken by a variety of people and used to start to look for opportunities. The reality is, in many communities around America, if you look at the number of people who have declining income or have no jobs, The fastest way to create jobs is not to try and get a job, but is to sit down and dig in and learn where all the governmental flows and money flows are in your community and figure out how you can re-engineer them in a way which is better for the municipality or better for the state or, you know, offers some kind of improved performance in exchange for creating local jobs. And municipalities that weren't open to that, or state governments or legislatures that weren't open to that 2 years ago, as things get tighter and tighter, you know, any group of people says, look, we can, you know, increase local income on the small businesses or new jobs or get these unemployed people working in a way that saves you money, that's going to fall on very receptive ears. So I would hope that you would, I would hope if that's of interest that you might dig in and start learning about your local community. If you want to start now, the first thing to do is to get the consolidated annual financial reports for your state. Your state website should probably have the consolidated reports for your county, or if you're in a big city, for your city. And then start, as you look through the consolidated reports, notice the where the biggest pots of money are. On the Solari blog, there's a list of links called Get Data. And if you start to go through those links and identify some of the different places that provide money, for example, there's one link that will show you all the U.S. Agriculture Department subsidies that come into your county and state. And, Franklin, I'm going to bring you in here. I remember coming over a couple years ago and getting you online and showing you all the ag subsidies that were coming into your county. Do you remember what your – do you remember your reaction?
Well, I was flabbergasted. I couldn't believe the amount of money. And then, you know, it went past that. You showed me how to figure out how much government money was coming in the and over 98% of it was from the Department of Defense or defense-related.
Yeah. Right. Every state in this country, if you – there's one of the links is to Eagle Eye, and you can look at what the biggest contracts and, you know, what the government agencies are spending in your state. And what you see is every state is entirely at this point a captive of Defense Department spending. It's unbelievable.
50% of the income of the gross domestic product of the state.
Right. Well, you know, one of the posts I put up last week was the Pentagon budget is now estimated full in to be $1 trillion a year. And that's the overt part.
Right, because the rest of it has got to amount to a minimum of, what, $7.5 trillion, because it's half of the national GDP.
Well, that is a war economy. So, Franklin, welcome. I'm over at Franklin's place over in West Point, Tennessee. We've just had an incredible dinner. Your meat is the best, Franklin.
It was good.
It was good. Yeah. Tell us about the market. We've had quite a run-up in silver.
We have, and there's something strange going on in the market, and I don't want your listeners to misunderstand what I'm saying, but it's almost as if after 7 or 8 months of turmoil, 10 months of turmoil, the market had suddenly decided to go back to normal. I'm not surprised that activity, a lot of dealers I talk to, in fact, most of the dealers I talk to, say that activity is really, their business is down, it's slowed down. And I'm not surprised at that because, you know, you had 10 months of basically this crisis mentality when people were just running into gold and silver. So now there's some confusion. Oh, is the stock market going to come back? Is, you know, are things going to get back to normal and so forth? And as long as that lasts and it coincides with a normal technical correction in the gold and silver markets, as long as that lasts, it'll sort of pull attention away from silver and gold. But that will be over. And the normal expected seasonal pattern is that you have a low in June or July in both gold and silver markets, and then they begin to rise again in the fall. But what else happened was that about 8 days ago, suddenly the premiums on gold and silver, various forms of gold and silver, began to drop, and they began to drop very, very sharply. I've never seen anything like this. The strange thing about it is there was nothing in the market, in the action of the price, that would have led to that. You know, what I'm used to seeing is this. For instance, let's take 90% silver coin. They have a fairly sensitive premium, and for years and years, when the premium begins to rise on 90% coin, you know that you're at a low. In other words, nobody will sell it, so the premium has to go up and up in order to pull any of it out. And then when you get a very long rise, a top like we had in, say, the spring of 2006 or 2008, where you're at an extreme top, then a few days before the top, the premium starts to come off and decline, and that's because, you know, at the top, people are anticipating a top and they begin to sell more. So that I'm used to seeing, but here we have a market that is rising, but but it's in a steady rise. It's not. This is not a peak type rise. This is not a paroxysmic rise. And suddenly, the premium just vanishes. On 90% coin at wholesale, on the buy side, dealers were paying $1.40 over spot, and within 3 days, it went from $1.40 over spot to 35 cents below spot. Krugerrands went on the buy side at wholesale, went from about 3.25% down to 1.25% today. American Eagles went from nearly 5% down to 2.75% today. Now, part of that effect, no doubt, comes from the fact that the U.S. Mint had suddenly discovered it had machinery. And, oh, look at this. We can mint coins after all. And so they resumed shipments of silver and gold American Eagles. And the American Eagles, you know, the silver American Eagles, which have consistently been the most expensive form of silver, they had carried a premium of $3.75 over spot. They dropped down to $2.25. So it's almost as if the market just woke up and shook itself about a week ago and said, oh, let's take all those premiums back to where they were before all this started.
Did the Mint give any reason why it was suddenly open again?
No, you know, well, they've been supposedly open before, but they couldn't find gold blanks, and they couldn't do this, and they couldn't do that, and all of it is just, you know, it was just sort of a bureaucratic shuck and jive, you know, about why they couldn't get things done. And then all of a sudden they started getting things done.
Well, it's interesting because we have GATA in London, Bill Murphy and Chris Powell in London, and visiting with mainstream investors and welcomed by mainstream press. And so it's almost as though somebody flipped a switch.
I didn't make that connection, but you're absolutely right.
Right.
They suddenly were taking heat and criticism that the U.S. government's in a conspiracy against the gold price, and then suddenly the Mint decides it can mint coins after all. That's just
a
coincidence.
Well, you know, I go back to my theme, which is the deal goes down. It's like somebody flipped a switch, and, you know, they've made their deals, and now we're in a new phase.
Mm.
One of the questions we get a lot is exchange-traded funds, ETFs.
Mm-hmm.
And you had an incredible article, Franklin, in the last Money Changer about your question about, is the inventory really there? Because one of the things I always talk about is, you know, I think an ETF is basically an IOU in a bank that's priced in precious metals, but it's not an investment in anything real. So I would love it if you could just brief us on what you found in your simple edition.
Well, let me say that there are two kinds of silver and gold in the world. There are two different kinds. There's paper silver and gold, and there's physical silver and gold. Everything you don't own in your hands is paper. I mean, that's just the way of it, because if you don't have it in your hands, it's a completely different thing. It's somebody's promise to pay you,
right,
silver or gold. And my suspicion since the beginning of this bull market has been that at some point in the course of this bull market in gold and silver, we would see the collapse of some large gold and silver scheme. Maybe it would be, you know, a futures market that revealed they didn't have all the silver or gold they were supposed to have. Maybe it'd be a storage scheme. Maybe it'd be ETFs or somebody else. But it would be somebody big. The thing that I have never liked about the ETFs is that there's no transparency in their reporting of what they have. Now, they'll say, well, we are transparent. We publish every day how many new ounces we bought or sold. But I'm not talking about that kind of transparency. I'm talking about third-party auditing that allows you to ascertain that they actually do have the gold and silver they say they own. And if you dig into the SEC filings of these companies, you see that what their documents call for is merely that they have a claim to gold and silver with some other depository, with some, you know, it might be located in a number of places, and the person they bought it from might actually not have it in his possession, but somebody else might owe it to him, and so forth and so on. So what you've got is just a standard string of Wall Street liabilities.
Right.
You know, Company A owes Company B, owes Company C, owes Company D. And that's a recipe for disaster. It's very interesting to see how much silver and gold they have accumulated, these ETFs. And there are ETFs in this country, and there are ETFs in England and Switzerland and in Australia. But altogether, the total silver in the three ETFs now is about 321 million ounces. And the interesting thing about that number is that CPM Group, who does a silver survey every year, estimates that all the loose silver in the world, and by loose silver, I mean, you know, what's ready to come to market and so forth, is about 400 million ounces. Well, that means that the ETFs have somehow accumulated more than three-fourths of all the physical silver that's ready to come to market in the world.
But the COMEX has 100 million.
But the COMEX has 100 million, right.
So the ETFs plus the COMEX have 21 million more ounces than exist.
Yes, according to CPM's estimate. And I'm not taking pot shots at CPM. I mean, nobody thinks that their figures are 100% exact, or necessarily an estimate, but something's not right there.
Right.
And why would any one, that's maybe four or five entities, what is the sense about them controlling three-fourths of the supply of available silver in the world? The gold is, that's happened since 2006 with the silver. In gold, they have about 42 million ounces of gold, all the ETFs together. And you have to think that that's about 1,300 tons. All of the central banks in the world in the last 100-plus years have only about 25,000 ounces, or 25,000 tons.
Right. It's amazing that how much money has flowed into paper, gold, and silver.
So let's ask a question about something. Because that demand, those dollars, flowed into paper, gold, and silver, what did they not flow into?
Right. They didn't flow into physical.
That's exactly right. So that's just that much demand that was soaked off of the market into something.
Right.
Something that satisfied the demand, but we don't know that it was actually physical silver and gold. So if you were the U.S. government and the Treasury, and you were engaged in a cartel and conspiracy to manipulate the price of silver and gold, and you had a growing, you know, daily burgeoning numbers of consumers and investors who are trying to buy silver and gold, this is like manna from heaven. This is a gift. You know, the ETFs come along and say, hey, we'll soak up all of this paper demand.
Well, the funny thing is, if you look at who's servicing some of the ETFs, it's the same institutions who've just been implicated in massive mortgage collateral fraud.
Right.
So if you're engaged in massive collateral fraud in the mortgage market, why would you be different in the precious metals market? And if the Fed and Treasury would allow you to do it in the mortgage market, even encourage you to do it, why wouldn't they let you do it in the precious metals?
Especially if you were some of the exact bullion banks who had been active
in suppressing the price.
In suppressing the price. And those are exactly the people who supposedly are supplying the silver and gold to the ETFs.
Right. I that's why I never understand the question when I get it. It's, you know, why would we trust these people? Now, I say that, and I do want to just mention that if you don't think that you know, if this is something that you want to buy that's not for the worst case, you want to buy a bank IOU that's priced in precious metals, there are, you know, there are hedging reasons why these instruments could be useful. I just think it's really important. If you use them, you need to understand what you're buying is a bank IOU.
Right. You're buying a claim on the gold and silver price.
Right.
That you're not actually getting the physical. And there's no provision in them, to give the devil his due, there's no provision in them that they will give you silver or gold in exchange for the shares. You know, one of the things I don't understand is why not just...
Well, there's not on the American. There's one European that will.
Oh, okay. I wasn't aware of that. But... You know, what I don't understand is why not go with something like gold money, where there's complete transparency of inventory third-party auditing, and the costs are going to be about the same. They won't be identically the same, but they'll be about the same, and you know the physical is there.
Because I'll tell you the reason is if you look at the cost of setting up an IRA account
mm-hmm.
through Gold Money and the fees, it's more expensive in terms of transaction fees.
Mm.
So if you're somebody and you've already got an IRA in a discount broker, it's, you know, it's probably five hours of your time and extra transaction fees to get to Gold Money. Now, it's all part of the transition to learning how to deal with physical,
because
mm-hmm. in the end of the day, if you want something that's real, it's worth making that transition. But that is, I think, the reason why a lot of people don't.
Well, you know, but you've raised a question here,
uh-huh.
and I think it's a very, very important question, and it's one of the mistakes that I see investors make, and that is they do things because it's easy.
Right.
This whole thing was set up because it makes it easy.
Right. It's all designed to make it hard to do certain things and easy to do other things, and you need to question that.
Right. You need to ask yourself, is this to my advantage or not?
Right.
Yeah.
Now, last week we discussed derivatives,
mm-hmm.
and I thought we could just take a minute or two and walk through what are the derivatives that relate to the precious metals market, both in respect to how somebody might use those derivatives and then also how they're being used to manage the markets.
Well, the two primary retail derivatives are options and futures. And, of course, you have to set up accounts with futures brokers to trade either of those. I don't like the futures. As I told you tonight, I bought myself a $100,000 education in trading futures. And
I think a lot of people have.
it requires trading futures. Requires an extreme amount of self-discipline. And if you're the type of person who can say, all right, I'm going to buy this stuff at this point, and then at that price over there, if it ever gets to that price, I'm going to sell it. If you have that kind of discipline, and you can look at a few key indicators, make your decisions, and not bounce back and forth every day with every up and down in the market, then you can trade futures. One of the things I don't like about futures is that the liability is unlimited. As long as you stay in the market, you're liable to meet a margin call, and that's liable to eat you alive if you have a bad position. Of course, one of the things is you should never stay in a position and meet margin calls. You ought to get out of the position when it goes against you. But what I found that can make money, and quite a bit of money, is a position in the longer-dated options. And what I would do is I would look to buy those options, first of all, at a time of maximum market pessimism. and you know why, of course.
Mm-hmm.
It's because the fellas that sell the options, they're retailers, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And when there's a lot of demand for their product, they raise the price. When there's not much demand, they lower the price. So the place that I would like to buy those options is when silver's at $1,180, for instance, or gold is at at $706, at lows in the markets, in other words. The next thing is I would like to buy the long-dated premiums. Options have a curve that looks like a mesa out in New Mexico. You know, it drops off very suddenly at the end of the life of the option.
Right.
So you pay more for a longer time, but you also don't have any of that time decay to deal with over most of the life of the option. And if you add time, you add opportunity for yourself to be right. The next thing is, you know, a lot of option buyers are tempted to buy cheap options. In other words, they want to go buy the way out of the money options, like when silver's trading at $12, they want to buy the $20 options. Well, you can do that, but those are generally more expensive, and the problem with them is that there's a huge part of the movement in the market that you're not going to participate in. You know, you're just there. You're waiting for the market to get closer to your price. Even though it's much, much more expensive, I think that you're better to buy what are called in-the-money options. Those are options that are already, they're either at the money. In other words, the strike price on the option is, say, if silver's at $12, you buy the $12 or you buy the $12.20s. So, you know, you're buying a product that's right at the market. that's going to be more expensive. But
right.
it also is going to be more responsive to changes. It's going to respond one-to-one for changes in the market.
Right, and the thing you have to do, if you're going to invest in options, you have to have the staying power. So you have to have a thing, because we're talking about something where the price is very volatile, and I suspect that's one of the reasons it's manipulated that way,
mm-hmm.
is to keep people out of the options market, you know, which would run it up.
Well, you have to know to allocate your money so that you don't risk too much of it.
Right.
But if you bought options, for instance, and you buy a $2,500 or $5,000 option, you have to take, you know, $5,000 bills in your hand, kiss them goodbye, and then go buy the option. And if you can't do that, you don't have any business doing it.
Right. You have to be prepared to lose everything. So it's not as bad as the lottery, but almost.
We hope it's a little more intelligent than the lottery.
Okay, so the question I get asked the most, the highest ranked vote on the subscriber panel, is where do I put my cash? And I think one of the things that inspires this question, Franklin, is so many people have gotten burnt, and you watch what's happening in the financial system, and you start to realize, oh my God, you know, I'm dealing with something that's sort of lawless and out of control, and who can I trust? I don't know what to trust. So I thought what we would do is, it's very important, I need to sort of say my standard disclaimer, everybody's different and every person's situation is unique. And so we can walk through what the options are, but it really depends on your individual fact pattern, what works for you and what makes sense. And everybody really, you know, is very unique and different. So with that said, I thought we could just walk through the different place, because this is something you and I have certainly dealt in lawlessness and figured out where to put our cash. So let's just walk through, and of course, number one on my list, you know, my favorite, even though it's many people would poo-poo it and consider it a little item, is what I call stockpiling.
Mm-hmm.
So as you know, I'm a stockpiler. I just found a new thing, the Crosby Mint Oil.
Mm-hmm.
I'm told by the guys at the Crosby Mint Farm, mint oil and essential oils have, essentially, if you store them properly, have an unlimited shelf life. So now, in addition to honey and booze, I have something with it. What did you say? You said there were three categories?
Food, firearms, and fire water. Those are the three that I think about. But I agree with you about stockpiling. And there's another advantage of that, too. And that is that if you're under conditions of high inflation, then whatever you buy today is going to be cheaper than what you're going to have to pay for it tomorrow.
Right. That's one of the big reasons I try and encourage it, is I just think if you look at the after-tax yield on a bank CD,
mm-hmm.
versus what you can get from, you know, sort of beating the inflation game with stockpiling,
mm-hmm.
it's a no-brainer. And there's no tax on the capital gains.
Right. If you're going to invest in toilet paper, make it real toilet paper.
Right.
Yeah. Because, I mean, absolutely.
Okay, so the second thing is investing money in things which lower expenses. I know I've just spent a great deal of money converting my pastures to orchards, and my plan is in 4 years I'm going to have significantly lower food bills because, you know, but I've also installed freezers and a generator, and I now buy my meat in quarter calves, which is saving a great deal of money on my food bill. So it's anything that can permanently lower your need for cash money. And I know you're the master of this, you and your family, Franklin. So,
Well, you know, I was just thinking, when listening to what you said, you were actually creating productive assets when you turned your pastures into orchards.
Right.
And that wherever you can do that, you're better off, yeah, when you can buy anything that frees you from dependency on other people.
Well, I knew I was onto something when my neighbors started fighting over my pecans. I have 7 pecan trees. No, they started fighting, and in fact, one of my best tree is over on the highway. My pecans were stolen. Can you imagine?
But think about this, too. You know, in a time when people are hungry and needy, if you've got food and you can say, well, you know, there are pecans out there on the ground,
uh-huh.
go help yourself, then you're creating a network of obligations, not, well, that's not the way, put it, I guess the best way to say it is you're creating a network of favors that you do for each other.
Right.
So that person has a reason to do you a favor later on.
Right. Now, the third place is to do anything that invests in skills, your skills or business that will help you generate either income or, I guess, what you would describe, you know, useful favors.
Mm-hmm.
But any enhancement of your ability to generate economic value both now and in the future. It's interesting. I have a number of people in the network I'm aware of that are going back, essentially at our age, they're going back to school, and they're learning new skills, and skills that will be valuable no matter where they go.
I think the emphasis is on the word skill, though.
Yeah.
I mean, if you want to go back to study 18th century French literature, that's wonderful, and that can be, you know, a lot of fun, but that's not the kind of skill that immediately, you know, people have to have every day.
Right, yeah. Right. No, it's something that makes you very useful in real economic terms. Okay, a fourth is keeping money or CDs or money market at your local bank. The next Solari report, the first one in June, is going to be how to find a good local bank. I've got two representatives of the bank that Solari uses, my bank, coming on. And, you know, and you and I have talked a lot about it, but a local bank is another place, particularly a bank that supports your community. I found that I'm in an area that has a lot of local banks and a lot of local bankers, and I've found that they're the sort of the financial know-how in the community. That said, the banking system is still subject to federal regulation, so they have to dance. They have to walk a fine line. Under your mattress, okay, area number five, if we get a after-tax 1% yield at the bank, you know, it's starting to look more and more attractive to just put the money under your mattress. Want to say anything about your mattress, Franklin?
Right. Well, that's the kind of money that I would just put into silver and gold.
Right.
And I would just hold it myself. Because the thing is, you know, you're talking about a 1% after-tax yield. Well, once you've counted in the inflation cost, the loss to inflation, you're going to turn up with something like 3 to 5 to 7% loss on those funds. Why not put them in silver or gold? And
right, and here's my challenge. If over the next year, let's say I have a business and I have working capital needs, and, you know, my payroll is in dollars, and then I have personal expenditures and people who, you know, who want money in dollars. So over the next year, you know, I've got a certain amount of dollar needs.
Mm-hmm.
Then the question is, how much do I keep in dollars, and how much would I keep in precious metals or something else?
Well, so, I know I've mentioned it before probably to your listeners, but there's a great little book, very small, maybe 100, 120 pages, by Gerald Swanson called The Hyperinflation Survival Guide.
Uh-huh.
You can order it off of ABE Books, and especially if your listeners are
it's very good.
Are business owners, they need to get that book because it really what you're talking about is how do I manage my cash under inflationary or hyperinflationary conditions.
Right.
When the cash is losing money, when the rule is dollars tomorrow will be worth less than dollars today. So I think at some point, not yet, that time is not here yet, but at some point everyone will learn, look, if I'm going to have any purchasing power at all, it has to be outside the dollar, and I only convert it to dollars when I immediately need to spend it.
Right. Well, as you know, you and I keep encouraging people, if enough people in a community start using gold and silver, then we have a way to trade without depending on the dollar.
Right, and then you get around all that whole exchanging problem, transaction costs and all that sort of thing.
Right. Another category is what I call local or family loans. I've said the story so many times I'm not going to tell it again, but when the litigation started, I had loaned or given to family and friends $250,000, and that was my major source of money for the first six and roughest years. And it kept me alive. And I discovered that being generous with family and friends and sort of doing high risk or character loans with family and friends was not such a stupid thing at all. that's one. And then, of course, there are local investments. So, you know, particularly for those of you who have the time, those of us who have the time, to get to know the different local business people, local farmers that we're sourcing things from, you know, whether it's our plumber, whether it's our electrician, whether it's, you know, one of the things that really reduces the risk on an investment is if you can take your return in goods and services that you know you're going to need.
Sure.
And it's really a strategic way of locking up the resources you need, because one of the things I've found and what I tried to describe in that story is, you know, the people are there for you are the people that you've banked because you've been there for them.
Right.
Another thing is other currencies. And, you know, one possible place to put your cash is other currencies. I know you'll probably agree with me, Franklin, what we've watched in the last year is not so much the dollar rise or fall necessarily just against other currencies, but all currencies look like they're falling against real things.
Mm, so right, they are.
Right. So the big cut is between do you keep your money in paper money or do you keep your money in real things? And then how do you navigate back and forth between the two systems, both in an inflation or deflation? I don't know if you saw this. I put up a, Franklin, I put up a country, two comedians spoofing and singing a country western song about inflation or deflation. And you got to see this up on the blog. And in it, they ask the question, will we be Zimbabwe or Japan? And that, for the listeners, the Zimbabwe is the inflationary example. They've had extraordinary hyperinflation in Zimbabwe. And Japan, of course, has been the slow grind, slow burn deflation example. One of my favorite money managers said the other day on a webcast, he said, you know, there are two kinds of bonds now, junk bonds and sovereign bonds. But, you know, of course, another place is sovereign bonds, but that gets you in the issue of, you know, are you in paper money or real things? The reality is that we do have countries that have significant resources in real things, and they continue to be sort of sterling credits, but there are not many of them. And then finally, the last place, and sort of traditionally my favorite place for cash, has been in equity investment, because I think ultimately what makes you know, a community or a country or a planet go is people creating enterprises that solve problems. I mean, I think you started the Money Changer to help people solve a problem. James Turk created, you know, Gold Money to help people solve a problem. I created Solari to do the same. So it's those kinds of businesses that really make things go. And if you look at where the jobs are going to come from, the Kauffman Foundation just published a report that we had up on the website and I talked about in a recent Solari report that showed 100% of the net job growth since 1980 has been in businesses that are 5 years old or less.
Mm.
So you know, if we're going to create new jobs and new income in this country, it's going to come from equity investment in reinvigorating the current businesses or building up and starting new businesses. So now the question is, how do you do that? You know, you can do that locally or through your network. There's all sorts of venture capital and angel investment going on. I've suggested people start Solari circles and explore that kind of investment. To do it now through the equity markets is challenging because the equity markets are so treacherous. You know, we've seen a real issues of questions of lawfulness. I got today, Franklin, an email that I'm trying to confirm from someone in my network, apparently a CEO fed up with naked short selling on his stock, went out, used a couple of different series of brokerage accounts, and bought up more than 100% of his outstanding float just to prove that there was such a thing as naked short selling. I haven't confirmed the story yet, but it's a, you know, it reminds me of your how much gold, silver is outstanding. Anyway, so equity, where do we find ways of putting our cash in equity, Franklin?
You know, I know that you're a lot more prone to use the traditional standing equity markets, but I have such a deep distrust of them. I think, I mean, we're moving out of an age where you trust people because they're certified by the state, they have licenses and so forth and so on, and we're moving into an age where you trust people because you know their word's going to be good, because they'll die if it takes it to make their word good. And how do you recognize people like that? Because you can be fooled. You know, this
right.
You know, this is one of the problems. But if you can find a local entrepreneur, or it might not be local, but someone you can work with who will take you on as an equity partner and share the profits with you in return for financing, that's the ideal situation. And of course, ideally, you would have four or five different people like that so you don't have all your eggs in one basket.
Right. My concern is if we don't find a way of creating liquidity for equity, you know, we're going to shrink so much of what is possible, and that's the danger with these exchanges really not being lawfully managed.
Mm.
Well, anyway, so a lot of different ways of places to put your cash. What is important to note about all of these different ways is they take more of your time and attention, or more of somebody's time and attention. The day we are not in an atmosphere as we were in the bubble that you could put money in a place and just not think about it, because we've seen what happens. That system doesn't work. So, you know, again, it goes back to my concept of financial intimacy. We need to know who we're investing with, what the money is doing, where it's going, so that we can be sure that it's really being used in a way which is protective of our interests and wishes with respect to our money. So, Franklin, thank you very much. We're going to go to the movies.
Oh, thank you.
If you want to stay on, I'd love to have your help discussing this.
All right.
I asked everyone to watch Point of No Return, which is a remake of the movie La Femme Nikita. In fact, if you want to, you know, if you said to me which is the greater movie, La Femme Nikita is probably the greater cinematic experience. Point of No Return is the American remake with Bridget Fonda. And for those of you who are interested in covert operations of this kind, there's a Canadian series made from La Femme Nikita called La Femme Nikita. It's a 5-season show. You can get it on DVD, which is really, I have it in the documentary list, is one of the best primers I know of for people who really want to understand covert operations, different techniques, tactics, and sort of the issues and culture of that world. So it's La Femme Nikita is a very interesting series. But the reason I wanted you to watch The Point of No Return is that about 2 years ago, a friend of mine persuaded me against my wishes to get a subscription to Oprah Winfrey's magazine. And so I started to get Oprah Winfrey's magazine, and on each page I saw a smile. There was a smile, you know, Oprah would be smiling on the cover, and there'd be all these people throughout the magazine who'd be smiling. And I kept having this weird feeling, I've seen that smile before. I've seen that smile before. Where have I seen that smile? And I started to pay attention when I was in the gym. The only time I see a TV is when I'm sitting on the Stairmasters and all the TVs are on at the gym. And I started to notice, you know, it's on the media, it's the same smile. Where have I seen that smile before? I went back and I watched Point of No Return, and there's a scene in Point of No Return where the character played by Bridget Fonda with one of her fellow female assassins is out on a job, and the job goes wrong, and they have to call in. They've killed too many people, and they call in, and someone shows up, someone played by Harvey Keitel, called, his name is Victor, he comes in, he says, hi, I'm Victor, I'm the cleaner, and his job is to clean up sort of messy, ugly situations and dispose of the bodies and clean the situation up. And in the process, Bridget Fonda's partner gets hysterical, and the cleaner kills her and turns to Bridget Fonda, and she starts to smile and assure him that everything's fine and she's not bothered by a little thing. And it's an unbelievable scene of somebody of perfect composure in a highly dangerous situation. And the words I associate with it is, I'm fine, everything's fine, we're fine. And I realize, you know, that's the smile I see throughout society. I see it all over the Oprah. I'm fine, everything's fine, isn't everything, you know, it's kind of chipper. And it started on the media, on the morning news shows, you know, when they stopped talking about news and they started talking about food. and you know, sort of having people talk about our deeper psychological problems, and everybody was fine, and everything was fine, and everybody was smiling. Now, why do I bring this up? You know, I have so many people tell me, you know, the people in my life don't know what's going on. They think everything's okay. And what I would say to you is, well, then why do they have that smile that you smile when things are dangerous and you want everybody to know that you'll play ball and it's fine? So that's number one. So somewhere deep down inside, they know that something's not okay. And because they wouldn't be telling you that things were fine otherwise. That's number one. The second thing, reason I wanted you to watch this, I watched this movie, but really focus on this part, is I want to make sure if you are in a situation like Katrina or a situation where you know, you come in touch with any kind of covert operation or a reality other than the official reality, I want you to understand how important it is not to panic, because oftentimes in these situations, you know, people in New Orleans found when the federal government came in or the Blackwater came in or the government contractors came in, they weren't dealing with people. You can't think of these people as human beings. They're people who are running a process. They have an agenda. And for a variety of reasons we won't go into on this call, they can't deal with panic. They can't deal with emotion. And they can't hear that what they're doing is horrible or wrong. It's very important for you to be able to deal with them in an incredibly matter-of-fact and rational way. And that scene will show you sort of the modus operandi of handling somebody under those kinds of high-risk stress conditions. And I think that's a little tool to put in your emergency preparedness kit. I hope you never need it. But it's a wonderful tool to have in your back pocket, and if you ever get in a high-stress situation, it can serve you very well. The other thing is it can help you understand a lot of those silly smiles you're looking around. Am I right, Franklin?
Oh, absolutely.
One of the reasons I love coming over to the Sanders Family Empire compound is you never see that smile. You know, you see Justin comes in from feeding the hogs. How are you? Oh, the hogs were brutal. Okay, well, that's it for our Soleri Report. You're in our prayers. We very much look forward to having you next week. We're going to be joined by Alistair Thompson, the publisher of Scoop Media in Wellington, New Zealand. And we're going to try and answer for you, how do you get the news? How do you get the real deal? How do you know what's going on in a way that is timely and entertaining and energizing for you? Our movie, not surprisingly, is going to be the classic network about the corporate media. Coming up in June, we've got, in the first week, how do you find a good local bank? I'm amazed at how many people still have a lot of questions after reading our bank intimate section. You can link to it from our homepage. We have a whole section on what are the steps to go through to find a good local bank. So two of the officers of Soleri's wonderful bank are going to come on to the Soleri Report and just walk us through, how do you find a good local bank? How do you interact with your local bankers? How can you interact with your local bankers in a way that helps your community? Our movie's going to be a fabulous comedy that will tell you more about the sort of red button problem than anyone I know, called Other People's Money, with Danny DeVito, and it's one of my favorites. Then, again, we're going to be back, Franklin, with you in the second week of June, and then the third week of June we're going to be addressing narco dollars, the rise of central banking and drugs, what it means to our communities, how to see it flow through the news that you're watching in your everyday life, and how to make sure you're protecting yourself from it. So until next week, please remember, don't worry about whether or not there is a conspiracy. If you're not in a conspiracy, then you need to start one. Good night and good luck.